Belgic Confession, Article 37, The Last Judgment. Finally, we believe, according to the Word of God, when the time appointed by the Lord, which is unknown to all creatures, is come, and the number of the elect complete, that our Lord Jesus Christ will come from heaven, corporally and visibly, as he ascended, with great glory and majesty, to declare himself judge of the quick and the dead, burning this old world with fire and flame to cleanse it. And then the last two paragraphs. We expect that great day with a most ardent desire, to the end that we may fully enjoy the promises of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. Amen. Even so, come, Lord Jesus. Now in these classes on the sign of gospel preaching, we've been exploring the progress of the gospel from the apostles to the year 1400 or so, and the reformers and beyond. And we've been doing this from the perspective of Matthew 24, verse 14, our key text: "This gospel shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then, and only then, shall the end come." You could say we've been putting together, and tonight we are especially putting together, two other texts. Revelation 6, verse 2, the first seal, namely the white horse that goes forth into all the world, conquering and to conquer the progress of the gospel. Revelation 6, verse 2, and Psalm 77, verse 19, which we sang earlier. "Thy way is in the sea, and in the waters great thy path. Yet are thy footsteps hid, O Lord, none knowledge thereof hath." This passage is teaching that God's way, now added to Revelation 6, verse 2, God's way in the direction and speed of the white horse is in the sea. You could say it, the white horseman is riding through the sea in a sense, although he's riding over land. But he's riding through the sea in this sense that you don't know what's at the bottom of that sea. It's hidden, it's deep, it's mysterious. And the gospel, the apostles, when they heard Jesus on the Mount of Olives speak about this gospel being preached in all the world, they would never have guessed beforehand the way it went. And even us in the year 2023, looking back at what has happened, it's still deep and mysterious. You wonder why shut up in Europe so long, and then when it did get out, why it went the way it did. So up to this point, we've looked at the apostles and the spread of the gospel. The spread of the gospel in the early church, working into more and more parts of the Roman Empire and a little bit beyond. Then into the medieval age. And then we've been fixing on the year 1400 or thereabouts, because at that stage, Christendom was boxed into Europe with the area formerly occupied by Christians in North Africa, north of the Sahara, lost to the religion of peace. And also the Middle East lost to Islam and the word of Muhammad. Then we noticed in the last two classes the big breakout with the voyages of discovery from the 15th century and onwards. A little bit of revision. What was the first European nation to spread its wings outside the continent through the Atlantic?
Portugal.
Next came Spain. And third, France. And then religiously, we said that Portugal and Spain were Holy Roman Catholic. Here, turn with me again to Romans 9, which we read earlier. This is talking about Israel. And Israel's rejection of the gospel of grace and justification by faith alone, compared to Rome's rejection of it. Rome's rejection of it was actually more emphatic, creedal, and with more anathemas than the Jews' reaction of the gospel of grace. And so what is said here about Israel applies even more so to the Church of Rome. Israel, which followed after the law of righteousness, I can obtain righteousness with God by keeping various precepts and so make myself good and receive acceptance with the Almighty. Israel hath not attained to the law of righteousness. Wherefore? Why? Because they sought it not by faith, but as it were by the works of the law. For they stumbled at that stumbling stone, namely Christ. And then if you look to Romans 10, Paul says regarding the Jews, his fellow countrymen, and this applies also to Rome with its advocacy of salvation by works, I bear them record. Publicly, I confess that the Jews, and I would say the same thing regarding the Church of Rome, I bear them record that they have a zeal for God. I mean, if you think of those Roman Catholic missionaries that went out into Mexico and Brazil and so forth and set up little mission stations in the mountains, they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness, in the Council of Trent from 1545 to 1563, they anathematized the gospel of grace, salvation by faith alone. They cursed it. If anyone holds this, let him be anathema. They, being ignorant of God's righteousness, and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. And then the apostle explains more about the truth of salvation by faith only. So Portugal and Spain, the first two nations that got out of Europe, and they did bring Roman Catholicism with them, brought the false gospel. Then we said, this is last week's class, France was almost wholly Roman Catholic, but there was a little Reformed presence, especially, and of course they were wiped out in St. Augustine in Florida and in Guanabara Bay in Brazil, but they especially managed to put down roots amongst other French Roman Catholics in what part of the world? Quebec, in northeast Canada. So almost wholly Roman Catholic, with a little Reformed bit at the start, and then Roman Catholicism sort of declined as the French Empire moved forward and more secularism came in. And when you look at this 1400 years hold up in Europe, then Portugal, then Spain, and finally just a little bit of Protestantism with the French Reformed, you have to say with Psalm 77, thy way is in the sea, and God's way was in the sea, as to who got onto the Atlantic Ocean and got into the Caribbean Sea and moved around and so forth. Tonight's class, we're going to look at two more individual empires individually, and then we're going to go to Africa. So, this is for my own benefit, largely, I admit. Who here likes geography? Who here especially likes world geography? World physical geography. That's what we're on today. Alec Goodman, you've come the right night. We have the map here to help all of us, especially those geographically challenged, shall we say. Now, listen carefully to this question, because especially some of the words in it are key. What was the next country in continental Europe? I'm giving you a clue. What was the next country in continental Europe to build an empire outside Europe by sea? So when I say outside Europe by sea, I'm ruling out the Russians, because that's not part of it. And I'm not talking about any empires within Europe. Okay, we have the Netherlands from Beth, and Mary's going that. Kristen, yes. And we would expect nothing less of you three ladies with your Dutch-American connections. It's interesting, the Dutch-Americans got it right and everybody else was silent. What you could have done is you could have gone along the progression that we mentioned earlier. Portugal first, look at the map, then Spain, then France, and then next along that southwest border of continental Europe, next is Belgium. And Belgium did have an empire. But Your answer is still correct, because Belgium only became a country in 1830. Before then, Belgium and other parts in the area were under the Spanish. They were part of the Spanish Netherlands under the Habsburgs, under the Austrians, the Austrian Netherlands. And then during the French Revolutionary Wars, they were under the French. But in 1830, the lowlands split into the Netherlands in the north and the Belgians in the south. And then a little bit after that came Luxembourg. And Luxembourg has been sliced and diced different times. And these three countries go by the acronym Belgium, Benelux, Netherlands, Luxembourg, the Benelux countries. But you're right, the answer is the Dutch. And the Dutch Empire started in 1602. Now, if you say, but how come there was the Dutch and then there was the Spanish Netherlands and the lowlands? Well, these people spoke Dutch and they were breaking away from the Spanish. And so if you rule out the Belgians on the basis that they weren't there till 1830 as a nation of Belgium, the Dutch are the next country along the western seaboard of continental Europe. Now let's talk a little bit about the Dutch colonies starting in the Americas, plural, the New World. New, not to the Chippewa tribe of natives, but new to Europeans. So in the north, there were Dutch in the North America. The Dutch settled where? Think of Peter Stuyvesant. They settled in New York, and it was called New Amsterdam. And then they called it New York when the British took over. So they settled in the New York area and elsewhere. In the center, Central Americas, where especially did the Dutch settle and move? In the central area. Not Mexico, not Nicaragua, but in the central area, the Caribbean Islands. The Caribbean Islands.
The Aruba Islands.
Aruba, yes, Aruba is one of them.
Curacao.
You were there, Brian, weren't you?
I was.
Remember you telling me about that? And St. Martin. And actually, Curacao and St. Martin, rather strangely, and Aruba. There's a number of people on our website. Their statistics come up very highly there, way beyond their population, what their population would merit. Then in South America, the Dutch colony is, remember, it's in those three small countries on the north coast of South America. It's in the middle. Suriname. And actually, there are some of the famous Dutch footballers who came from Suriname. I think Ruud Gullit, for example, his family came from Suriname. So outside those places in North, Central, and Southern America, there are two other main places associated with the Dutch around the world. One is in Africa, South Africa, and then later it went British. And then in the rest of the world,
Indonesia,
which is a very large territory, relatively considered, and there's a massive population, and it's mostly Islamic. And Indonesia was a real prize in those days because of the spices. And other countries wanted Indonesia, and the Dutch hung on to them. Now, the Dutch also had trading posts and were in other regions for a while. Interestingly, the Dutch had trading posts in Brazil, northeast Brazil, in Ghana, in India. The Dutch controlled Sri Lanka for a time, and Taiwan, and Mauritius, which is an island chain east of Madagascar, and you can see that on your map.
Timothy said that whenever he was in Sri Lanka, you could see the Dutch influence.
Timmy said that?
Yes.
When he was in Sri Lanka?
In the churches and in the buildings.
Yes. Yes. When we were in Malacca, the Dutch were there, and then the Portuguese were there, and the British were there, and you could still see in some of the old buildings relics of each of them. and in the street names too. So having said that about the Dutch, what religion were the Dutch? They were Protestant. What type of Protestant? They were Reformed. That was the state religion. I mean, there were some Arminians at various times, there were some Roman Catholics there, but the state religion and the majority position was Reformed. And of course, there were some Jews there too. So they held to the three forms of unity, our Belgic Confession, Heidelberg Catechism, and the Canons of Dort. And in terms of Romans 9 and 10, here we have the gospel of righteousness by faith alone. Believe in the Lord Jesus with all your heart, and you are saved. Whosoever believeth in him shall not be ashamed. There's no difference between Jew and Greek, no difference between European and non-European. Anybody all over the world who calls on Jesus, but of course they can't call on Jesus unless they've heard of him, and they're not going to hear him without a preacher. And how beautiful are the feet of those who bring the gospel of peace. So that was the religion, insofar as the religion was brought, the Dutch, according to those who are authorities in such matters, the Dutch didn't quite push religion as much as some of the other European powers. Like I think the Spanish, for instance, were promoted Roman Catholicism in their colonies with the power of the state. It was much more concentrated and deliberate than the Dutch did, and there were some actually Protestant places that pushed it harder too. But the Dutch are actually the ones who are bringing, of all the European colonial powers, the ones who have the best gospel when they're holding that up, we're holding to that. Now what about the main influence of the Dutch religiously? Within the territories that were theirs for some time, think of South Africa. I'm going to stick as much as possible with our contemporaneous South Africa. It was sort of more like the Cape Colony and the Transvaal and different things earlier. But and then they're of course near around the coast, but then they moved inland. Well, there you had a recognizable Reformed community, and then over the generations, they moved into Namibia too, to the north and west of South Africa. And there a new language was born. The new language of Afrikaans, which is number 7 on the CPRC website with 196 translations as of today's date. I looked into it. So there's a transplanting of Dutch Reformed people and religion, and it's spreading. Then if we go to Indonesia, you have a number of three forms of unity churches in this Islamic land. If you get a sort of catalogue of Reformed churches, you'll see all these. Now, I don't know how faithful they are, and I'm not implying anything negative, but you say, huh, they have, on paper at least, the three forms of unity just as we do, and that's because of the Dutch influence there. Indonesian, before you ask, it's the language, it's number 10 language on our website. We have 155 translations of that by two brethren from Jakarta. Cheryl, they're ethnic Chinese in origin, are these two main guys, nice fellows. And in terms of the people who come to our website, number 1, America, more people on our website from America than anywhere else. Number 2, Brazil. And number 3, Indonesia. Number 4, the UK. So there's more people on our website from Indonesia. And these statistics, actually, they're remarkably the same. Day in, week in, you know, the numbers figure, but the order's pretty much the same. Month in, and even year in, Indonesia is typically third. Sometimes it passes Brazil into second. And we have to give thanks to that, and it's to the Dutch, because if the Dutch hadn't gotten there, and of course for these two guys influenced by the Dutch who did these translations. And of course Indonesia is so high up that list because there are some 279 million people in Indonesia. I think it's something like 10% some form of, you know, Christian. Then, of course, aside from their own colonies of South Africa, though they were later dislodged, from rulership at least, but not from the land, and Indonesia, the Dutch, and the Dutch Reformed influence has been very strong and a great blessing in the USA and Canada and Australia, as well as other parts. Now, what's the next empire that we're going to treat, unless there are any other comments about the Dutch? Unless any of the three ladies think that we need to lay it on thicker there about how good the Dutch were and how important it is that we... Brian?
The British.
The next one is the British, yes. So the British Empire was only really called as such in 1707. Before that, really, you talk about the English Empire, and that includes the Welsh. It began in 1585. It became the British Empire in 1707. Why 1707? The union with Scotland, where the parliaments were united in one parliament in Westminster. The union of the crowns had taken place earlier in 1603 with James I, but I'm going to refer to the whole thing as the British Empire, as most do. It was the largest empire that the world has ever seen. At its height, it governed over a quarter of the area of the world and just under a quarter of the population of the world. Now, I'm going to talk about the different places that were in the British Empire. Some were in the British Empire for centuries, some much, much shorter period of times. We're going to omit the possessions in Europe, which included Cyprus, Malta, Gibraltar, and even the Ionian Islands of Greece. After the Napoleonic Wars, the islands on the west of mainland Greece and other places, because we're talking about the spread of the gospel from Europe, so we're not going to talk about that. And when I talk about the British Empire here, as with other places, we're including what came later to be referred to as protectorates, or dominions, or territories, or mandates. And when I'm referring to these places, I'm going to use today's terms pretty much, which should make it easier for us. Let's start with the Americas and move from the north to the south. Canada. The main opposition there, of course, was the French. The US. And by the US, we mean really the 13 colonies, which then went from sea to shining sea over the next, under their manifest destiny. And the 13 colonies, that's up until 1783. And of course, these 13 colonies, and then as they spread further west, they were settled by pretty much all different peoples from Europe. And then after sort of everybody in Europe sent some of their people over there, then practically everybody from all over the world sent some of their people over there. Then if we go further south, the next territory south of the US, staying on the mainland, is, Brian, Belize, which used to be called British Honduras. And then there was the Mosquito Coast there, which actually isn't named for mosquitoes. There was a Mesquite tribe was there, and it was just called the Mosquito Coast, but it was, of course, heavily infested with mosquitoes, like the whole area. Then there were all sorts of Caribbean islands, and the Caribbean islands, in terms of the colonies, were the plits that changed sides most. You know, one year it's French, 5 years later it could be Spanish, then maybe it's Dutch, and then maybe it's divided between the two for a time, and on it goes. But Caribbean islands, and probably the West Indies, is the bit that sort of encapsulates the British part most, including Trinidad and Tobago. And then, of course, there were other islands in the Atlantic, such as St. Helena, and everyone knows the most famous resident in St. Helena, or guest, or shall we say prisoner, Napoleon. They have a fantastic
runway, you know, because it's so isolated, and then the winds and so forth, and they had to build it. Anyway,
not that Napoleon was ever able to use the runway or anything like that. And of course, the Falkland Islands, and some of us remember the battle for the Falklands and the sinking of the General Belgrano. And then in Africa, Cecil Rhodes spoke about building a railway from the Cape, meaning South Africa, to Cairo in Egypt. And eventually there was a time when you could have done that, staying within British territory. And then, of course, South Africa, actually, the country of South Africa, it received as a mandate Namibia from the Germans. And then the British parts, sort of on the west side, you've got Nigeria. You can see Nigeria on the map. Nigeria, Ghana, where the PRC had mission work. And the benefit of that, you see, is they speak the lingo. They speak English. Sierra Leone and the Gambia. Let's move to Southern Asia. The jewel in the crown in Southern Asia was India. And of course, India then included the countries to the west and east, namely Pakistan and Bangladesh. And once India gained its independence, there was a civil war with the Muslims in the west and the Muslims in the east breaking away, forming Pakistan and Bangladesh. South of India, that big island where Timmy was and where he was almost stuck because of the whole COVID outbreak.
Ceylon,
which was now known as Sri Lanka. And then in the Indian Ocean, you have the islands of the Seychelles and Mauritius, which belong to other countries at different times. And then if you go east from Bangladesh, you've got Burma, now called
Myanmar.
If you go north from India, you've got Nepal and Bhutan. They were sort of protectorates, the euphemism of the day. And then, of course, west of Afghanistan, the British made several forays and occupied land in Afghanistan. And they also got some serious hidings in Afghanistan over the age. The climate was pretty rough. So moving from South Asia to East Asia, what have we got there? In the very furthest south, we have Singapore. And around Singapore, we have
Malaysia.
And then going north, past French Indochina, we have the island of Hong Kong. And what's someone called from Hong Kong? He's a Hong Konger. So moving now to the Middle East, as it's popularly called, and this is sort of later in the British Empire, and this was news to me when I looked into this. British territory in the Middle East included the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Qatar, Iraq, Transjordan, which includes Jordan of the day, Israel, Palestine, Kuwait, Oman, and Yemen. In fact, if you look at the map, you see Saudi Arabia there. You spotted Saudi Arabia in the Middle East. The area to the south and north and east surrounding Saudi Arabia was all at one stage British, actually. Then if you go to Oceania or Australia or Australasia, you've got Australia itself and New Zealand, of course. And then, such was the development of colonialism, the colonies started to get colonies. Remember we said that South Africa got what's now called Namibia? Well, Australia got Papua New Guinea and Nauru. And New Zealand got Samoa and Tokelau. And actually, what happens with the cool colonialism is that whenever you lose a major war, you lose your colonies. And you lose them to the people who beat you in the major war. So it's always kind of tricky. Then you go to the negotiating table and then you hand out little chips and I'll give this to you and you allow me to keep this. And then, of course, there were other South Sea islands. The French had some around this area too. The Americans would govern some in the Pacific later. South Sea islands like Fiji and Tonga. Now that's our geography lesson over for the while. We'll come back to geography later. Let's move to what we're really interested in, the religious significance of this. What religion did they bring, the British?
Protestantism.
They brought Protestantism, yes. That was probably the number one religion they brought. They also brought some Roman Catholicism with them, and especially as time went later, some secularism, but not as much as the French. The religions that they brought with them, the British, it was the same as with the Spanish, or before them the Portuguese, or the French, or the Dutch. They brought with them the same religions and roughly the same percentages as what there were in the home country. And these sort of transported themselves elsewhere. So, in terms of Roman Catholicism, there's especially one American state that got most Roman Catholicism, or more than any other state, and that was a deliberate policy. Which American state was that? So we're back now to the days of the 13 colonies before George Washington.
Massachusetts.
No, not Massachusetts. That's Massachusetts, a good one though, because Massachusetts was all about congregationalism. I mean, there were Presbyterians and Quakers there, but it was about... Yes, but Boston is strongly Roman Catholic. Was later on, the Roman Catholic Irish came there.
Maryland.
And Maryland was named after the Blessed Virgin Mary, yes. But it was named after Henrietta Maria of France, who was the wife of Charles I, because she was a Roman Catholic and the king wanted. And then you see Baltimore himself. The city was named after him. He was a Roman Catholic. And then when they called it Maryland, they were also thinking, you know, not only the... But you see, why was she called Henrietta Maria? Because of the Virgin. And so they were thinking, this is a place for Roman Catholics. But interestingly, though there was more toleration in Maryland than in other what came to be the 13 states, the Roman Catholics still had less than 10% of the population. So they had more freedom, but they still were very far from the majority. Sticking with the Roman Catholic aspect a little bit longer, not just Maryland in the Americas, but Singapore. Sir Stamford Raffles, the key man in early Singapore, the governor, was a Roman Catholic, 1820. Yet actually Singapore had far more Protestant influence, because it doesn't always go by what's the religion of the governor. There are other factors, and then he didn't stay actually there that long. So Protestantism was brought, Roman Catholicism, secularism, but then Protestantism, as we've been hinting, needs to be explained. What was the preferred form of religion in the British Empire? The preferred form, and it was preferred especially by the people at the top. The Church of England, Anglicanism. And in some of the places, Anglicanism, where there was a significant number of settlers, became basically the established religion. Though they found it harder to keep it as the establishment religion than they did actually in England. What other forms of Protestantism?
Presbyterianism,
which was especially the religion amongst...
Ulster Scots.
Of the Scots, thanks Billy. And it was the religion of the Ulster Scots. That's what they brought with them too. Two places, as Brian says, like the Tennessee. Then there were the Congregationalists, and the Congregationalists were strong Hillary in
Massachusetts,
and also in and around Massachusetts, Connecticut was a big. So,
are the Puritans considered the Congregationalists?
The Puritans are kind of they're kind of a different type of classification. You could have Puritans who were Anglicans, and Puritans who were Presbyterians, and Puritans who were Congregationalists, and Puritans who were Baptists. But probably, especially in the days of the Westminster Assembly, the Puritans were probably more Presbyterian. So then there were Baptists who went out as missionaries. There's a famous Baptist missionary in Burma, for instance, Myanmar. And then Quakers. See, if you have a significant group,
in the homeland, the Quakers went on. And what U.S. state was associated with the Quakers?
Pennsylvania,
named after William Penn and that whole family. And Pennsylvania was a very tolerant society, because the Quakers were all about tolerant, because they had a minimum of truth and a maximum of toleration. And of course, Pennsylvania actually then became more Presbyterian, because they were so tolerant and there was a good number of Ulster Scots there. Later we have the Methodists and various other groups. And then, of course, these various Protestant groups under that broad umbrella, they varied by definition. And you could look at their creeds. They varied in faithfulness to the gospel, set forth, for instance, in Romans 9 and Romans 10, both terms of truth and the lie. And they varied over time. So, for instance, the Congregationalists departed more quickly in general than the Presbyterians when apostasy began to cut in through modernism. And the Methodists, of course, started off worst and apostatized quickest, because their creed was Arminianism and free will from the start. And then when modernism came in, they led the way in English speaking denominations, they led the way in apostasy in actually every country. They went modernist pretty much first. Then, of course, there's the role of religion. You know, so you have religion and its various hues and stripes and in the home country. Then the settlers and the missionary work, they're promoting some sort of brand of Protestantism. And the role of religion varied in the British Empire, and it also, this applies to all the other European empires too. The role of religion would vary over time. At one stage, they might be trying to promote it. At another stage, let's go easy. Then it would vary according to place. More people might see it advantageous in a certain place to promote religion, but another place, no, don't push it so hard here. The natives might come and do some bad things that you really don't want. And then sometimes the role of religion in a certain time and place would vary with a new administrator. So this one, let's say he's Anglican, so he wants to rule Anglican. The next one, let's say he's more secular, and he doesn't really care. And then, of course, it's not just the governor, it's the traders, it's the missionary, it's the people themselves. And then, of course, there is the fundamental ambiguity regarding gospel preaching in the British Empire and in other empires. Because on the one hand, the gospel is a justification for the empire. Because people realized, even then, you need to justify this, because people are being killed here. So we need to justify this. And then the various imperial powers, the justifications would vary in the head of one person to another person. It would vary in one empire and another empire, and they vary over time. But some would say, we're here and we're bringing civilization. So we're building roads, we're irrigating, let's say, the Punjab, and we're improving laws, we're raising the standard of education, we're bringing in Western medicine, we're building hospitals here. So civilization, that's part of our mandate. This is why we're here. The main reason, especially at the start, was about trade, but it was always there and probably always the main, is about making money. And also, for many people, a bit of adventure. Let's hit the sails. Then some people left because they were broke, bankrupted. Other people left because they were maybe going to go to jail. Or some people had an imperial experience because they had just been sent to jail and the British jails were too full. So we sent you to Australia. And we had to send you to Australia because we could no longer send you to America, because the Americans had just revolted. And we used to send them, especially in America, to the state of Georgia. Georgia. Yeah. So on the one hand, the gospel is a justification along with civilization and trade and so forth. But on the other hand, the gospel is a threat to your empire. Because if you bring the gospel and you challenge native customs and you annoy too many people with too strong an influence there, you could get a revolt. And this issue of gospel as justification and gospel as trouble especially played out in one
arena of the British Empire? India. It played out in India. It played out in India because people would say, you know, those people, they're engaging, for instance, in sati. Sati is widow burning. So if your husband dies, you've got to do the honorable thing, ladies. Jump on the funeral pyre and burn yourself. That's the way to go. Now, you didn't have to be terribly religious or very strict in your profession to think from a Western perspective or from anybody's perspective that sati isn't a good idea, and it really got people in home in Britain annoyed. So we need the gospel because people need to be saved. We need the gospel because there's these horrible Hindu gods. We need the gospel because of sati and other things. Maybe too the gospel will help us with the thugs. And who were the thugs? The thugs were the ritual stranglers in Indian society. And they would kill tens, hundreds, thousands of people traveling. They'd ingratiate themselves to your group, and then they would strangle you, and they'd all sorts of rituals and so forth. And this was in service of a pretty nasty Hindu god. And the British said, you know, we've got to stamp out sati, and we've got to stamp out the thugs, the thugis. So we need some religion for that. But if we evangelize too much, what might happen? The natives might rise up. And in India, that happened with the mutiny of 1857. And so you got Lucknow and other places. So the gospel preaching is good. It's a justification for your empire. But if you do too much, it can be a threat. There's this ambiguity. And then, of course, there are various parties in an empire. I'm explaining from the British one because I know a little bit more about it, but it applied to other empires too. Various parties didn't want the gospel in the colony. We don't want it at all. I'm openly ungodly, one person would say. I left the old country to get away from religion, and these people are going to increase over time. And I don't want to hear the gospel at all. Keep it in Britain. They have this pagan religion here. They don't bother me. I kind of like it that way. But more people would have said, okay, we'll have the gospel in the colony, but we don't want missionaries to evangelize the pagans out there. We want ministers for those settlers who want ministers. We don't evangelize the surrounding peoples. And then you see, if you think of the British, of the various parties who were there, some of them didn't want gospel preaching, like the government at certain times. The East India Company was in India for what reason?
Money.
And they're making a fortune, and they need to keep the shareholders right. And then if you bring over missionaries, well, the missionaries don't actually make you any money. You have to subsidize them. Then they annoy the natives, and it's going to be harder to trade with them. Keep those people at home. And then to move forward a bit, someone like C.H. Spurgeon, he's saying, we need more missionaries in India. God has given us India. We're here for a time. Now we've got an opportunity. Let's preach the gospel to them. They've souls, and they're going to perish in their unbelief and idolatry. So there's a government, a classic example, the East India Company, don't send missionaries. And then you've got traders. Well, say you've got trappers going out into Canada and America, and they want the tails of the poor beavers that never hurt anybody apart from blocking the rivers. You know, the traders, they have to get along with the natives. They don't want missionaries coming and bringing them the gospel. These are pretty rough, hardened guys. Oh, you've got them annoyed, but I need to buy and sell with them. So the traders don't want. And then the settlers, some of the settlers are saying there's no point evangelizing these people. They wouldn't even understand it. That's what the people were saying at the time. And besides, if we do bring the gospel to them, we'll have to teach them to read and write somewhere along the line. Then they will develop, and then they will... What's that?
Rebel.
They will rebel. They'll want us out. They'll begin to think and discuss and develop ideas and realize that our presence and occupation of the land may not be in their best interests. And this was an issue especially with slaves, we'll say in the States. Many people said, we don't want the gospel going to our slaves because
Next thing you know, they might start thinking, and the last thing you want is people thinking. This happened in India as well. I'm explaining a little bit of the various factors here because it is quite complicated. Through it all, the gospel spread in different places. It wasn't the gospel, but it's general to say that where the gospel did spread, it spread slowly and it was patchy, right? In general, there was a movement from the coastal areas where the settlers would come, of course, and then they'd move inland, and so the gospel would sort of move with them. And then over time, the gospel would reach the natives, although not everybody in the colonial party would actually want that. And then, of course, the results weren't always terribly good, and there was a lot of apathy and disinterest from the natives, and sometimes horrendous backsliding, and then you baptize some guy, and you think, man, he's made a good, credible profession of faith, and the next day he's out worshipping the totem pole or something, and then you tear your head, think, I've been out here for all these years, have we got a genuine convert among the whole lot of them? So syncretism was a big issue. So the gospel would spread via the Christian people, and then the natives had difficulties knowing among the white settlers who were Christians and who weren't. They would sort of think they were all Christians, and then some of the natives would get drink and guns and so forth from them, and some of the settlers were a terrible witness. Complicated, as I said. So the Christian people, and then of course there were missionaries. Possibly the most famous missionary to the natives in New England, John Eliot, and Jonathan Edwards did some too. In India, we have, for instance, the St. Andrews Seven, under the influence of Thomas Chalmers. They went out to India in the 1820s from the University of St. Andrew. Sometimes the missionaries would go ahead of the settlers, deliberately to reach the unevangelized, and then sometimes the missionaries would come behind. And then the missionaries can be hard to understand at times. One of the most famous British missionaries in the Victorian age was David Livingstone, I presume. And there he is in Africa. And then the question is, and I remember as a young Christian getting a book about him, his diaries, and I was rather disappointed. I thought, well, he's not really bringing much gospel here. So how much gospel was he bringing? And how much civilization was he bringing? Who was he actually working for? And did that change over time? Because he's going into the African interior. He's mapping the land. He's building contacts with the people. He's trying to bring civilization into inland, massively inland Africa. And trying to work out navigable rivers and whatnot. And you're thinking, that's not exactly missionary work, this. Has his goal changed over time? What exactly is going on here? I mean, he was a remarkable man, incredibly energetic and self-taught, and his endurance was amazing. And I probably could lead more, but could read more and understand him better with more time. But I mention him, and then you can let the name drop away, because there's that ambiguity too about what exactly the missionary is bringing, not only in terms of the gospel, whatever the gospel might be, but is he bringing gospel or civilization? And then again, how can you bring pure gospel to people who civilizationally wise are sort of further behind when you represent a whole culture? And that's, of course, the problem with missions in the third world that contains to this day. Then, of course, in keeping with the different sorts of Protestantism that were exported, certain parts of the empire really reflected this. The island of Fiji, for instance. What's the big form of Protestant religion in the island of Fiji? Methodist. Over a third of the people in Fiji, the last count, the one that I saw, over a third of the people in Fiji are connected with the Methodist Church. Fiji is the most Methodist island or country in the world. Fiji. There you are. What about Uganda? So a lot of Methodists went there and they had more, you know, success. What about Uganda? Anglican. Uganda's very Anglican. So there's far more people in Uganda go to an Anglican church than
on the Lord's Day than Englishmen in the Church of England. And they're much more conservative and Christian. So their point is, if the Archbishop of Canterbury says these horrible things contrary to God's word, and he's promoting homosexuality by tolerating this and promoting people who hold those views, why should he speak for Anglicanism? Actually, we're the real Anglicans, because we hold Anglican belief. Here's an interesting example, New Zealand. Let's take the City of Christ Church. What group of Protestants do you think settled Christ Church?
Anglicans.
The name gives it all away. Christ Church. They were Anglicans. And interestingly, they were influenced by the Oxford movement, which was a Romanizing movement in the Church of England, brought great apostasy into that denomination. But staying in the South Island of New Zealand a little bit longer, moving from Christ, from Anglican Christchurch, the people who settled Dunedin, what part of the British Isles do you think they were from? Dunedin. They were from Scotland. And Dunedin is the Scottish Gaelic for Edinburgh. So they go over. So you've got in Edinburgh and the Antipodes, you know, practically the other side of the world from Edinburgh. Dig a hole from Edinburgh and you'd probably come somewhere near Dunedin. That is, if you dug your hole straight down through the middle. So, Dunedin. So there you've got this side. That's an Anglican settlement up there. That's English. That's Anglican. Church of England. And then here in Dunedin, we're largely Scottish and we're Presbyterian. And what sort of Presbyterian were they? They were Free Church of Scotland people who founded it. So there was the great disruption, the formation of the Free Church of Scotland in 1843. And the first minister to labour there was the Reverend Thomas Burns of the Free Church of Scotland. So he left the Church of Scotland, joined the Free Church of Scotland, which started in 1843, and then he was the first minister in Dunedin. His name was the Reverend Thomas Burns, and he was the nephew of Robbie Burns. So Robbie Burns's nephew became the minister in Dunedin. And he's teaching Scottish Free Church principles there, which is good. It's good to hear that something good came from the family of Robbie Burns. Any questions or comments on that? Do you feel oppressed with all that information, or are you still holding up okay? We're covering a massive subject very, very briefly. Could say an awful lot, but we're saying this because we need to get to the religious significance of it in the light of Matthew 24, verse 14. And at the end, we sum it all up, you'll see where we want to get to. Let's move on then. There were two other significant European Reformed churches that we have not yet mentioned. So European Reformed churches, sort of connected with specific countries that had a significant Reformed presence. So we've looked at the French Reformed, the English Reformed, Anglican, the Scots Reformed, Presbyterian, the Dutch Reformed, two others that we haven't mentioned yet.
The Swiss
Reformed. Alex, going really well. And there is a German Reformed, Hilary. But the German Reformed, it was always very small, and large parts of it defected to Lutheranism. It was generally weaker. But that was the number three answer, if it makes you feel any better. So no. So the one and two were the Swiss Reformed and the Hungarian Reformed. The Hungarian Reformed. So what should we say about the Swiss and Hungarian Reformed? What about the Swiss and Hungarian empires outside Europe? What should we say about them?
Not much.
Not much. Why not, Alec? They didn't exist. And why was there no Swiss Empire or Hungarian Empire outside of Europe?
Neutral.
They're landlocked. They had no navy. So the key to this expansion was, as we've said, the sea, the Atlantic. Of course, there were other reasons. The Hungarians were influenced by other powers and so forth, and they weren't just the wealthiest and whatnot. But landlocked, that's the key thing. Now, there was a little period in time when Hungary had a limited access to the Adriatic. So if you go sort of south and west of Hungary, they had a little corridor that goes through what's now Croatia and maybe part of Slovenia too. But that's relatively late, you know, pre-World War I in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But even then, let's say you could develop a navy. Even then, your ships would have to go all the way around the boot of Italy. And then you have to head west through the Pillars of Hercules, the Straits of Gibraltar. And then everybody else has got there first. And then how could you build enough ships? You know, so they're off to a massive, massive disadvantage. And here's the providence of God here too, which is inscrutable. God's way is in the sea. The Swiss Reformed at one stage, along with the Dutch, were probably the best Reformed churches in Europe, but they never got a chance. They're up on the mountains and they're far from the sea. So they had their day. They had John Calvin, who was a Frenchman. They had all these creeds. They had an influence. The Swiss, let's just stick with them for a moment. Theologically, massive influence, but they never got a chance to spread it. Let's now come to Africa. Africa. Of the world's six continents, we're not going to say anything about the Antarctic, of the world's six continents, where does Africa come in terms of area? Second biggest. Yeah, Asia's the biggest. In terms of population, Asia's the biggest. Where does Africa come in? It is the second biggest population too. So second largest in terms of area and population currently. I don't know comparative figures, I don't know if anyone does, for the 15th, 16th, 17th century for population. Now there is a period from 1880 to 1913, so just before World War I, that though the European empires, and we've said this in previous classes, had been there for quite some time, and there were areas that were influenced by the French, let's say, or the British. But that period, 1880 or 1913, is known as the period of the partition of Africa. Partition, because it was divided up into many parts. Sometimes it's referred to as the scramble for Africa. You know, when you think of scramble, you think scrambled eggs, or you think scrambling, there's a raid coming over in World War II, and you're scrambling to get into your planes to meet the enemy in the air. But the scramble for Africa, it's quite expressive. Everybody's trying to get their hands on bits of it, because it's going to be partitioned. I want a bigger part, a bigger slice of the cake than you, or at least as big a part as I can get. We have here the colonization of Africa, or you could call it the carve-up of Africa. Now, we have already mentioned the empires, several earlier empires. What did Spain have in Africa? So now, think of your map here in front of you. What was Spanish?
Guinea.
There's Guinea, yes. Spanish Guinea. It's in a little bit of Cameroon. And Cameroon is south and east of Nigeria. So there's a little bit there, Spanish Guinea. And then there was a wee bit Spanish Morocco, just across the Straits of Gibraltar, and the Spanish still have, well, you spell it C-E-U-T-A. How do you pronounce it? Ceuta, something like that. And then the Spanish also had Western Sahara, as it's now called, which is sort of south of Morocco. So the Spanish, a few wee bits. What were the two parts, the two main parts, because there were other bits, that were Portuguese? Northern Namibia, Angola, and then east of Zambia, it's not on the map, Mozambique, that's Portugal. What bits did France have? The big French island was for a time?
Algeria.
Ireland, Madagascar in the Indian Ocean, and yes, they had Algeria and most of, but not all of, Northwest Africa. And they didn't have, as I said, what's now called
the Ivory Coast.
If it was Côte d'Ivoire, as you're right, then it's French. Well, it's along the Gold Coast there. Yeah, but it's definitely French. Yeah, I should have remembered that it's called Côte d'Ivoire. So we went the Spanish bits, the Portuguese bit, the French bit, the Dutch bit. of Africa. Remember we said it used to rule south of South Africa. That was the Dutch bit. And then the British, we had the Cape to Cairo, South Africa to Cairo, up the east side through Egypt and Sudan and Kenya and various other countries like Zimbabwe and whatnot.
Did the Dutch take that over then during the Boer War?
The
part of that South Africa?
The Dutch actually lost their in the Boer War, or the Boer Wars. The Boers was like the Dutch word for farmers, and then the Dutch thought the British came over, and the British were far too, didn't understand their way of life and were anti-Boer. And the British seemed to be puzzled why the Boers didn't want to be part of the empire of Queen Victoria, and why they didn't want her laws, and the Dutchmen didn't like it one bit. And not Britain's finest hour down there.
Spy on cop,
that's right. Yeah. Which was a total shambles from a British military perspective too. And then of course, Nigeria and Ghana and Sierra Leone, mentioned earlier, they were other British colonies, but we'll move on. Now, Africa was carved up, this carve up of Africa, the scramble. We've mentioned the Spanish, the Portuguese, the French, the Dutch, the British. Then arose some new colonial powers, because everybody wants in on the big game. And they actually, some of them really wanted the big game. Some of them wanted an empire, so they'd go and hunt big game. Yeah, and go and hunt lions and so forth. Sounds like great fun. That was what the wealthy did in those days. So the Belgians came in. Ha ha, the Belgians finally have their slice of the pie. And what was the country that the Belgians ruled?
Congo.
Belgian Congo. And among the imperial powers, the Belgian Congo, which was the personal fiefdom really of King Leopold of the Belgians, he gets a hard time now because they didn't treat the natives well. Probably it was the worst treatment, or almost the worst treatment. The Italians, they had an empire, you know, over 1500 years before. Now they're the Roman Empire. Now they're having their sort of second empire, you could say. What parts of Africa did the Italians scramble for and carve up?
North.
Yes, well, if you think of the French going south, you get Algeria. The Italians went south and the Italians took Libya. Yeah. And the Italians took Eritrea and Italian Somaliland up by the Horn of Africa. You see Somalia there? It's written in the western part of the Indian Ocean of that map. And then Anga. Then the Germans came in. And which parts did the Germans take? Cameroon, east of Nigeria, and Togo, to the west of Nigeria. Namibia, and there were some atrocities there with some of the Herero people in Namibia, north and west of South Africa. It used to be called German Southwest Africa, and Tanzania. The Germans got Tanzania, and the British, who wanted the Cape to Cairo railway, oh no, the Germans got. But then after the Germans lost World War II, of course, you lose your territory, and then the British got it, so you can build your. Anyway, so the Germans also had some territory outside Africa, unlike the Belgians and the Italians. There was German Samoa and German New Guinea in the South Pacific. So there was all of Africa was carved up apart from one little bit. Anyone know the bit that wasn't taken? Though the British had their eyes on it. Nope, that one was carved up.
Liberia?
Nope. Liberia, that was sort of like American. And Liberia comes from the word liberty. So freed slaves, the Americans had influenced there, free slaves went to Liberia. The British put freed slaves in Sierra Leone.
Zambia?
No, it went British. It's Ethiopia. Ethiopia. So Ethiopia stretches out her hands to God. Ethiopia was the one that wasn't taken. It was in a plateau. And then Ethiopia was sort of Christian. They had a form of Christianity. And there was always that strange idea that you can colonize the European powers out. You can colonize practically anywhere As long as it's not Christian. As long as it's not Christian. It doesn't matter who's there. If they're not Christian, it's fair game. But maybe that was part of their thinking as to why leave Ethiopia there. So Ethiopia was left untouched in Africa. And Thailand was the bit that was left untouched in Southeast Asia. They allowed the king of Thailand his territory. The British were to the west of him, and the French were to the east of them. Now, having gone through all that, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French, the Dutch, the British, and then we brought in some other colonial powers in connection with Africa. Now, let's look at our map of the world. Let's take the big picture. We're coming very near the end. Remember we said that there were six continents in the world, and are, of course, and three of them, from a European perspective in the year 1400, were new continents. Now, by this stage, North America, it has been divided up among Europeans. I mean, some of these countries are going to get their independence. The Spanish and Portuguese territories, remember the Spanish and the Portuguese are taken over by the French in the French Revolutionary War. So North America, the main ones there, Britain, France, Spain. What about South America? Main power, Spain. Next, Portugal, and then a little bit for the Dutch, British, and French. That's the western third of the map. They've all had some sort of Christianity coming in from the coasts, right? The third new continent, Oceania, Australia, New Zealand, British, Papua New Guinea, British through the Australians and these various islands, and then the islands in the Pacific. They've all had European influence, for good or ill, and of course various diseases have been spread and caught. Then we have the three old continents. So we've dealt with one group of three, then we have the three old continents. Europe, well, we've already said that. From 1400 there was some sort of Christianity in all parts of Europe, including Iceland. Then we go to Africa. Well, Africa now has been carved up apart from Ethiopia. And even then, there are ambassadors in Ethiopia from all the European powers. And then Asia, you take there Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, just go along the South Asia coast. You go west to Oman, Yemen, India, Burma, the French parts. Then the European powers all had some influence in China, a little bit of gunboat diplomacy. We're going to make you buy our opium. So the kind European powers, we're going to force you with our gunboats to buy it. And then Japan eventually tried to stay out. And there were some Roman Catholic missionaries in there. It was a bit more resistant. Indonesia, the Dutch, the Philippines, the Spanish. And then later on with the Philippines, they had a massive influence from America. So you've still got some inland area in Asia. But by the end of the imperial age, pretty much everywhere's touched. And if you say, well, they've gotten the gospel that Paul denounces in Romans 9 or 10, that's true, but there's greater global trade and influence of other parties. And these countries, at least now, they've been discovered from a Western point of view, and now they're included. You know how to get there. You know how to reach them. And you can, if you can get a missionary in there, you can actually get the word to them. So now, for the first time, and through this rather strange way, with all its goods and ills of imperialism, which today is really a bad word. At one stage, the world thought it was really good. Now the world has this different sort of ethics, and it thinks it's wonderful. And if the world lives another 50 years, people 50 years' times will say, see the 2020s, really, really corrupt, very wicked stage. Now we know that this is a good thing to be doing, and they weren't doing it, and this is a bad thing to be doing, and they were doing it, and the whole thing, the scales will turn again. So don't hook your ethics to the spirit of the age, because the spirit of the age is going to change, and it's going to leave you a widow. So don't do that. Stick with the scriptures. So here we have it, guys. This takes us to the global period. And then, next week, we can talk more about modern missions and technology and so on and so forth. Anyone else, any points to make? And to return to what we said earlier, if world geography wasn't your stronghold, next week will be a little bit of a relief for you. It won't be as much global geography.